Godspeed Institute with Carol Hollenbeck, Sundays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Care Hallenbeck. The Tao gave birth to one. The one gave birth to two. The two gave birth to three. And three gave birth to the 10,000 things. The 10,000 things carry yin and embrace yang. They achieve harmony by combining these forces. This from Taoist Text and Philosophy. Joining us today in a conversation on Taoism is Norman Girardeau, University Distinguished Professor in Religion Studies at Lehigh University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. His special research areas include Chinese religious tradition, especially Taoism, popular religious movements, the rise of the discipline known as comparative religions, and the relation of religion and outsider or visionary art. He is the award-winning author of The Victorian Translation of China, Taoism and Ecology, and Myth and Meaning in Early Taoism, the Theme of Hundun. Norman, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Yes, indeed, Care. I'm delighted to be here with you and also to know that we've got an audience out there who has some interest in hearing about Taoism. So that's quite wonderful.
Great, yes. And I must say, I looked through some of your materials preparing for this program, and I saw one of your courses that I have to ask you about, the course Jesus, Buddha, Mao, and Elvis?
It has a little bit of a ring to it, doesn't it?
Jesus, there's a grabber.
Alan Elvis. Yeah, there's a story, of course, to something that has a title like that. And, you know, in some ways, Care, I suppose it fits in with what we're talking about, that is Taoism, because, you know, Taoism is one of the few religious traditions in the world that has a sense of humor about the strangeness of it all. And the course title was meant to be provocative and a little bit strange and hopefully even a little bit humorous, you know, tagging Elvis at the end. But frankly, it was a very serious course, and I won't give you all of the details, but the gist of it is, and frankly, I don't teach it anymore. After 9/11, I decided it was in some ways too dangerous to teach. Yes, indeed, because you might have thought about the fact that it's Jesus, Buddha, Mao, and Elvis. It's not Jesus, Buddha, Confucius, and Elvis. Or Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, and Elvis. Some things that get a little bit tricky. But the whole point of the course was that I became more and more interested in the issue of where things come from. In fact, the quote that you took from the Tao Te Ching to open the show is a kind of creation myth story that sets the context for the Taoist view of the world. But more generally, the issue of where things come from is an overriding issue in terms of comparative religions, and for that matter, for all of us as human beings. To know where something comes from is to know, to some degree, how it is now. You know, what's the one question that we can all ask, the most profound question of all? Why is there something rather than nothing? And to get at that, you have to think about origins. So anyway, what I was thinking about is the issue of where do religions come from? And where do religious founders, how do religious founders play a role in that issue of the creation of a new religion? And it has to do with cult movements and what happens when a cult is no longer just a cult or a small new movement, but becomes a part of a cultural tradition and then a religion.
Then
is accepted. But even more interesting is the issue of who the founder is and the fact that, as someone has once said, if you start to poke around in terms of the narratives associated with religious founders, it almost seems they all live the same life, you know. Now, I'm using that expression very broadly, but there are certain patterns. And you know, you could take Joseph Campbell, the idea of the myth of the hero, but there are other aspects to that as well. But what really then intrigued me was that in the 90s, when I was thinking about these things, the whole Elvis Presley cult was going full blast.
And, I recall a song from back then called Black Velvet.
Well, yes.
Where he was referred to as a new religion that'll bring you to your knees.
Absolutely. And so what relation is there between the emergence of a celebrity cult and the emergence of a religious leader? And that's not to say that they're the same thing, but certainly there are patterns there that help you to understand, one, the role of celebrity, and then the issue of that kind of process as it attaches itself to religious leaders. Was an amazing and wonderful thing. And actually, the first time I did that course, I realized that, just as you said, there were many things out there that indicated that some people were quite religious about this. And as you know, there's so-called Death Week, or as you may know, there's Death Week in Memphis, which is a ritual event that has religious trappings in a very blatant way. But even better, there was something that I discovered online called the First Church of Elvis the Divine.
Oh, my gosh.
And I got in touch with those people and brought them to my university. And it so happened that the AP Wire picked it up, and we made the front page of the London Times, and then Lehigh alums would pick up their local papers and see that there was an Elvis cult at Lehigh, and thank God I had tenure, Karen. but it
Stop
made
security.
An important point, you know, that all religions start out as cults, and that indeed the forces that are associated with the cultivation of celebrity are also the forces that are associated with the appearance of a religious leader or founder. So anyway, that's one of those things that I've done over the years that is kind of a ritual attempt to get at some of the key issues that are out there in terms of the strangeness of the human condition.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that, because as you know, the more you share, I realize, yes, there's a reluctance to accept the death of certain celebrities, you know, that they live on. That they are worshipped.
Right.
You know, so I see where you were. That's a great point, and probably a field of study all on its own.
In fact, it is, Care. I mean, if you start to look into it, you'll find that there are quite a few books written about the issue, specifically in terms of Elvis, but in terms of the larger issues as well. And, you know, for me, I see myself as a comparativist, which means that I give myself permission to examine the strangeness of things, wherever it may be. So I do Taoism, yes, but I do a lot of other things as well. And I studied at the University of Chicago under one of the last of the great comparativists, Mircea Eliade, who was the Romanian scholar. And he was the one that imbued in me this need to always keep my eyes open, never be afraid to take a look at, as I say, I like the expression, the strangeness of the human condition.
Yeah.
And I use that in a very positive way. Sometimes when I say that in class, students start to get very nervous that I'm somehow using it pejoratively. But no.
Well, I also appreciate your mentioning the word humor before as well, because that falls in there, the ability to not get the humor just in creation, but in ourselves, to be able to laugh at ourselves, I think is crucial.
Absolutely.
In spiritual life.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, you know, in that course, we don't need to spend the whole show talking about that course, but I must tell you that the culmination of that course is where we performed a ritual event that made use of the sound power of Australian Aboriginal Sharingas, which are sometimes called bull roars. The vibrational energy that was unleashed by that, and you can say the vibrational energy is indeed the power of the Tao, helped to materialize Elvis, who appeared on a motorcycle on campus and proceeded to bless the students. And that made my reputation as a very odd professor. But as I say, thank God I had tenure permitted to do that. But anyway, I mean, I've done many strange courses. As a matter of fact, right now I'm doing a course which involves building a Chinese pavilion in the community, in the Bethlehem community, which is a bringing together both of engineers and technical people with architects and designers and art people. And it's an attempt to bridge cultures, China and America. It's an attempt to bridge disciplines in terms of the technical and the more aesthetic or liberal arts. And it has a wonderful Taoist edge to it because, you know, a pavilion is a way station. As we walk the path of life, you know, we need to pause periodically and realize that the best way to live life is to see it as a pilgrimage. And so the idea of the pavilion, at least for me, because I'm the head professor, I get to indulge myself. I have them reading the Tao Te Ching and Zhuangzi. And it's a very interesting experiment in a kind of comparative approach to religion.
That sounds just fantastic, you know, and a great place to visit. Now, why don't we, I want to return to that opening quote, frankly, about the Tao. And the, you know, the giving birth to one and the two and the three, of course, brings to my mind some similarities with other, you know, images. For, you know, for example, the triune God in Christianity, or what is called the Holy Trinity, that there's a threeness involved here that, you know, has confounded some of us in Western theology throughout the centuries. And perhaps... could you share more about this, the one, the two, and the three in the Taoist tradition?
I would love to. you know, the first book that I wrote, Care, was the book Myth and Meaning in Early Taoism, the theme of Hundun. And I should mention to you and the audience, Hundun is a technical Chinese Taoist term for the primordial chaos, for the womb at the beginning of things. That's the Tao is in a sense equated with this principle of Hundun. And as the quotation suggests, that at a certain point Hundun starts to vibrate in some fashion, and from that comes the One. In a sense, it's already one, but it starts to, as I say, pulsate and create something else. And from that one are the two principles, the digital principles of reality. And as I think most people know, whether they're Chinese or Americans, the yin and yang are being referred to there. But yin and yang, these are code words to refer to the dualistic, the digital nature of all things, up and down, male and female, on and off. Indeed, you can argue that the Chinese had a digital understanding of reality way before we ever caught on to that idea. But it becomes even more interesting because, as you said, from the two comes what? The three. And then from the three come the 10,000 things. Again, let's just make the point. The 10,000 things is a kind of code word in Chinese, which simply means everything. That's the world that we live in, the realm of many things. So the key to the world that we live in is the principle of the two. And we know, don't we, in terms of the world that we've created now for ourselves, that indeed everything can be set in terms of on-off, in terms of yin-yang. But the real key to that is not just that there is on-off, not just that there is light and dark, not just that there is male and female. It's what is between them. It's the third term, so to speak. And the third term in Chinese tradition can be thought of in different ways. Ordinarily, it's thought of as the qi, and the qi is the matter energy, the connective tissue between the two things. It's the joint between what's up and what's down. It puts the two into a balanced or harmonious condition, which then allows for the production of everything. So everything can be said, as we know, in terms of a digital approach as we understand it today, and in the Chinese vision of things, indeed. It is the two, but it's the joint between the two that allows for the creation of the multiple realm, the world of 10,000 things. So, yes, you're right, Kerr, that the idea of the three is something that is deeply embedded, actually, in almost every culture. And it becomes a religious principle in many cultures, of course, which you alluded to in terms of Christianity. But, you know, it's exactly, not exactly the same, but there are these very interesting parallels to, for example, in Mahayana Buddhism, where you have a so-called three bodies doctrine. And as I think you know, in terms of the little homework you may have done about Taoism, that in later Taoism, there is also, at least in so-called religious Taoism, there is a kind of Taoist trinity. And surprisingly enough, it's somewhat similar to the Christian idea of trinity, because you have the celestial worthy, as it is sometimes called, of the primordial beginning, that is, the person who is a kind of creator god. And then you have the principle that is the in-between principle, the messenger, the Holy Ghost in Christianity, the Holy Spirit, or as I indicated to you that in Chinese tradition, it's another principle of spirit that is both matter and energy. And then the third principle is the celestial worthy of the Tao and the Da. And guess what that is? That's the embodiment of the Tao on the earth to show the rest of us how to find harmony, and that's Lao Tzu. That is, it's an incarnate kind of idea. So isn't that curious?
That is.
That we see this kind of pattern in many different religious traditions. You know, I think in Taoist tradition, you can probably argue that what becomes this idea of the three gods, a kind of trinity, the so-called celestial worthies, that was primarily influenced by Buddhist tradition, the three bodies doctrine in Buddhism. But the larger point was the one that I was making, that is, that this resonates with many other traditions.
No.
So in other words, Care, there are mysteries out there, that reality does harbor a strangeness, that once we recognize it and once we open our eyes to it, should make us pause, should make us wonder, should make us be curious, and not to fall back upon some kind of predetermined idea about what it means, but to be open to the mystery, to be open to the strangeness.
Yes.
And that it's always moving. You know, the Tao stays the same by always changing. The Tao, in a sense, is time itself. The Tao is not a transcendental principle. It's not out there or over there. The Tao is a part and parcel of matter. Spirit and matter in Chinese tradition are intrinsically interrelated.
Now, I have found that the Chinese word Tao is often translated as the, you know, quote, the way or the path.
Sure.
And again, Jesus' disciples originally were called followers of the way, which is intriguing again. But can you share more about the meaning of this word in the context of a way or path?
Well, of course, as I said, the idea of Tao is, first of all, a dynamic principle. It's the pattern of change and growth and development. It has to do with what your network calls itself, the progressive. It has to do with that dynamic element that is written into the heart of reality. So all things have a way, and there is a grand way that is the orchestration of all those ways. In fact, you could argue, again, interestingly enough, that in one of the other very early Taoist texts, the Zhuangzi, Zhuangzi was another early sage figure, you have a discussion of that principle, that is the Tao, which in many ways is surprisingly reminiscent of what becomes in our tradition the whole idea of evolution, that the Tao is the principle that is the pattern that unfolds in many different ways or paths, and that each of us have a path that is our distinctive or unique path that is given to us to follow. The problem in human life is that we wander off our own path because we have other people waving signs at us, you know, follow me, go this way, go that way. And we lose sight of who we are. We lose sight of the path that really is our path. And that leads to disaster.
Yes, yes. That's not even taking Facebook into account.
Exactly. I would say, you know, what would a Taoist say today? He would probably say, get off of Facebook at least for a while. Don't do so many emails. Yeah. And don't Twitter. But that's speaking as an old man.
Wow.
Here. I do email, but I avoid tweeting and Facebook.
Well, you know, that's an important part of today's life, is to make those kind of choices precisely on, you know, our own health, our spiritual health, or where we want our mind to be and our energies to be in a time of increasing and fragmented, you know, information sharing. That's not the same as wisdom or knowledge by any means.
That's absolutely the case. And we've made ourselves also frantic about keeping up with things, whether it's keeping up with the latest blog or keeping up with our Facebook or whatever else it may be. I mean, I think we've all recognized the tragedy of email, this wonderful way to communicate. But I don't know about you. I get up in the morning, I say, okay, I'm going to go through my email quickly and then do some real work. And you can spend the whole day.
Yeah.
Playing with your email. And that's not your way. That's not your path, you know. It's too easy to get distracted. We need to slow down. And again, those are all kind of very basic, you know, human lessons. In some ways, Taoism is not some kind of arcane philosophy. It's a prescription for rediscovering common sense about oneself and about the world we live in, and the fact that all of us walk a path. Life is a journey. Human life is a journey. You know, it has a beginning, middle, and end. And there are certain phases of transition between those nodes that we need to pay special attention to. I'm getting ready to retire. That's a transitional moment. I need to pay attention to that.
I need
to realize that in retirement, I don't have to somehow cling to what I was doing before.
Right.
And all of these things are very difficult, but in some ways it does go back to common sense, you know.
Yes, and being really present through all, there are so many transitions through life that being present helps us to make meaning of them as well, you know, handling the transitions well. And in that context.
And that's,
you know,
finally what religion is all about. Religion is a machine to make meaning, you know.
Wow.
I like that expression because it kind of sometimes throws people when you say a machine to make meaning.
No, it's great. Thank you.
But what
what time frame did Taoism emerge? And in response to what? Because I don't think it's very arcane at all. It's rather, it's more current.
I agree. There are a number of people, commentators, that suggest that Taoism in many ways may not necessarily be the religion of the future in terms of some kind of organized new religion that you have to raise your hand and say, I believe, because Taoism doesn't want you to do that, but a new kind of spirituality or religiosity that doesn't require the kind of heavy-handed exclusivity element that we find in other traditions. But in terms of where it comes from, and that's a good question, because it comes from a period in early Chinese history when actually before the creation of the Chinese Empire, this is in terms of dates roughly around the 6th century to the 4th or 2nd centuries BCE, and China was still a feudal country. It has it. It's made up of a number of small feudal kingdoms, which when things were harmonious in terms of there being a kind of feudal lord and people were organized together under that lord, things moved along quite nicely. But obviously there is an imbalance built into that kind of system, and the little kingdom started to jockey around for power, which is to say that the Tao was lost, order was lost in the universe, people were dying, and people were looking for meaning again in their lives. This is the great period in early China where we see the great sages appear, Lao Tzu, Mencius, Confucius, and so on, who are responding to the chaos that prevailed. And as I say, people looking for meaning. And the question, the way they would ask that question is, where is the Tao? How do we find the Tao again? How do we find our path in the midst of the turmoil that surrounds us? And each gave somewhat different answers. You know, the beauty of Chinese tradition is that, yes, you have different sages, different points of view, but there's always an understanding that these things finally must work together. There's never a sense that one has to take a pledge, as I suggested before, that, okay, I'm a Taoist, but I'm not a Confucian or I'm not a Buddhist. The real issue is that all of these things refer to the fact that there are different kinds of human beings in the world, and even if we take a single human being, each of us goes through different moods and different attitudes in our life. Sometimes when we get up in the morning, you know, when we're worrying about our job and getting to work on time, we're Confucian. You know, we're thinking about the day-to-day ritual that we have to go through. There are other times when we're thinking about our health and we're thinking about, again, who we are in confrontation with all of the forces that push us in different directions. We're feeling a little Taoist and Buddhist. And so on. The point is, you know, the great saying in Chinese tradition is you have three so-called traditions, but finally, the three are one. And, you know, that idea is sometimes abused and is not always something that is carried out, but on the whole, there is that recognition. So anyway, the point is, Taoism goes back to that point in early Chinese history. That was a chaotic period, and Lao Tzu appeared on the scene. And if you say, well, who was Lao Tzu? You know, it's probably best to think that Lao Tzu is a kind of label. Indeed, the word Lao means old. The character Tzu can usually sometimes translate as master, the master Lao, or the old master. But there are many puns possible and multiple layers of meaning in Chinese. And as you may know, sometimes it's translated the old boy. You know, there's a legend about Lao Tzu that he literally was old. When he popped from his mother's womb, he was already 72 years old.
Goodness.
And he had earlobes that dangled beneath his kneecaps. But what is that tell us? It tells us that the Chinese, much more than we ever were able to, realize that these are stories that are mythic stories. They're symbolic in nature. You're not supposed to take that literally, you know?
Yeah.
And who is Lao Tzu? I think one of the best ways to think about who Lao Tzu is, Lao Tzu was the tradition of the wisdom of the elders in the villages and towns in early China. It was what was passed down. It was a kind of common sense tradition that was passed down through the association of elders. And then it becomes attached to this name, a person, because we need to personify.
Right, right. We need some focus somehow on a human person, I imagine. But this is very pertinent right now, what you're sharing about the wisdom of the elders during a time of chaos, which we can relate to. Very much in today's times with all of our challenges. We're about halfway through the program right now. I want to continue with this after our break. You are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network. When we return from our break, we will continue our conversation on Taoism with professor and author Norman Girardot. Let's spend a couple of minutes now with Michael Franti. Stay with us.
It keeps my boat watertight. fight. They wanna drink my blood of courage and try to take away my fight. But no, 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 they can't do that. No. For one truth I learned in life, you want to scare away the vampires, you simply guide them into the light. Wake up in the morning, I hope I see you in the light. And when I wake up in the morning, I hope I see you in the light.
Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. You are live with CARE, and we're talking about the mysteries and wisdom of Taoism with professor and author Norman Girardeau. Norman, we left off discussing Lao Tzu, the attributed founder of Taoism, as we know today. Can you share a little more about him and his life and experience?
Well, as I say, what we know of his life is extremely limited, and in fact, there's only one very short passage in a much later text. So-called one of the first Chinese historians around the 2nd century BCE. One of the basic legends, I prefer the word myth. You know, a myth is a powerful story that in a sense uses a symbolic language to communicate a truth that can't be communicated in any other way. And, you know, the legend of Lao Tzu is that, one, as I told you, you know, the probably best way to think of this is that this is a reference to a tradition of wisdom that becomes personified at a certain point. It's, again, it goes back to what we're talking about, you know, Jesus, Buddha, Mao, and Elvis. Just to say that Taoism comes from a tradition of wisdom, we need to have a person that we can identify with. You know, part of the power of the Christian story is precisely the story of Jesus as a person that loves you and that you can love him back. Indeed, you know, there's an interesting aspect to that, because today in China, where there is a religious revival going on, the curious truth is that perhaps the one religion that is the hottest, to use kind of pop expression, is Christianity, especially evangelical Christianity.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that.
And part of it is the power of the story. In some ways, Chinese religions were deficient in creating a story that has the emotional pull that the Christian story does. That's not to say they weren't always telling stories, but, you know, there was an advantage, I think, in Christian tradition that seized upon the single powerful story of Jesus the Christ, who is risen and then is available as a friend and as a savior. In Chinese tradition, you know, the revelation is ongoing. There are many, 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 many stories. And that in some ways is a good thing, because depending on where you live, what village, you have your own story. But in terms of a larger, more universal appeal, it's a kind of hindrance. Keep in mind, Taoism never sees, until recently, has never really saw itself as what you could call a missionary religion. That is, it was a religion for the people of the land, who lived in villages and towns and needed to have the story that gave meaning to their lives and the ritual actions that made life a journey, a rhythmic journey, and allowed them to continue their lives from birth through old age through death. So it's only recently that Taoism, you know, started to become more of a world religion, and then it becomes problematic, because just you say, well, who was Lao Tzu? Well, Lao Tzu wasn't. We don't have a good story for Lao Tzu. You know, there's the story of the blue ox, where Lao Tzu got fed up with the situation in China. Nobody was really listening to him, so he hopped on a blue ox, and he rode out west into the mountains.
A blue ox? Didn't Paul Bunyan have one of those?
Well, you know, exactly. Yeah. Yes, indeed, that's the case. But I'm leading up to something even better, Care, which is that he stops in the mountains, and the gatekeeper in the mountain pass puts him up that night and is very kind. And when he gets up the next morning, the gatekeeper says, well, you know, I have a feeling about you that you're a very wise person. Can you just give me a few words of wisdom? And as the story goes, he then says 5,000 Chinese characters or words, which become the Tao Te Ching. But the real punchline is he then disappears into the West. Guess where he ends up? Of course, he ends up in northern India, where he teaches the young Siddhartha.
Oh, my. Right.
So, well, this whole business of the role that stories play in all of this is a terribly important issue and something that I don't think we want to get sidetracked on.
I think it's important what you mentioned earlier, because, you know, here in the West we lament people leaving churches in droves in search of an alternative form of spirituality, where we also notice that as you mentioned, in the East and in China in particular, the really exponential growth of some evangelical Christian communities, and as you also mentioned, the closeness to the land.
Yes.
And to nature, for people, living in the countryside and such. How is Taoism practiced, let's say, on a day-to-day basis? And could you then share also more about the connection to nature?
Sure. And, the issue of how Taoism is practiced, the best answer to that is simply to say that it depends. It depends who you are, what your station in life is, what kind of person you are, and so forth. That is, often people talk about a so-called philosophical Taoism and a religious Taoism.
Right.
And in some ways, that's a kind of, I don't like that distinction, because it actually is not so much a Chinese distinction, but a Western imposition or a way to sort out what we thought we knew about Taoism, which was to say that philosophical Taoism was some kind of higher or pure form of Taoism that went back to Lao Tzu and the Tao Te Ching, and then later Taoism, which became organized and institutionalized, that was a kind of corruption. And that's not, I think, a very good way to think about what is really going on. There are types of people, in some ways, maybe both you and I, Care, fall into the category of being that sort of person, because we talk about ideas and you have a radio program and I write books and so on. We tend to live in our heads more. We indulge in abstractions and words. And that's what some people would have called the philosophical Taoism, or what in other traditions you might call a more mystical form of Taoism.
Right.
It deals with the spiritual just as spirit, or at least attempts to get to a purely spiritual level of meaning. What Taoism is always saying, however, is be careful. There's no such thing as pure spirit. Spirit is interconnected with matter. The religion of the people, the organized Taoist religion, the people of the land, that is a religion of the body. They're not intellectuals. Most Chinese were illiterate until very recently. And that was a religion of ritual, because that's what you did with your body to follow the path or the way of your life as a village person, and to mark those key transitional moments, both in the seasonal round and in the larger cycle of one's own journey of life, being born, growing up, getting married, growing old, and dying. So, if you say, how is Taoism practiced? In the best sense, it's always an attempt to bring together spirit and matter. So the problem for intellectuals, if you want to put it that way, is to realize, yes, ideas, concepts, words, what's going on in your head, that's all wonderful and good. And yes, spiritual issues are wonderful and good, but you got to get it back into your body as well. You have to reconnect, the matter and spirit. What does that mean? It means you need to work with your body. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to do something terribly special, like some special form of meditation. It could mean riding your bicycle, you know.
Or in our case, shoveling a lot of snow.
Well, I guess you're up in Maine. Yes, yeah. Very little snow this winter. But that's the important thing, to realize the need to reconnect the spiritual and the material. And that, as a matter of fact, everything fine, you know, the brain is in the body. The brain is part of the body. And spirit, because in the Chinese sense of things, spirit is qi, and qi is matter energy. It's both matter and spirit at the same time. And so, you know, that's the key to it. It depends what your station in life is. If you are a person who has a way of life that involves bodily things, you're going to follow a ritual path, and you're going to go to temple, and you're going to do things in terms of the village community, and there'll be a seasonal ritual cycle, etc. But you'll always be concerned with the practicality of things. You know, the Chinese are the most pragmatic, and some would even say earthy, of people. Religion, finally, is earthy, you know. Yeah. What is religion concerned about? Yes, at times they talk about heavens and hells and all that, but finally religion is about how to learn to live this life.
Right.
And that's an art. That's something you have to cultivate, and you have to cultivate it through your body as well as your mind. And yes, meditation can be a part of that. But frankly, one of the problems we Westerners have is that when we discovered these other Asian traditions, we got so caught up in the mystique of meditation as some kind of secret method that if we could only learn that, then all our problems would be solved. We really didn't appreciate that meditation, yes, has a role to play, and yes, probably in many ways it was more appreciated in Asian tradition than in the Western tradition. But on the other hand, meditation in that narrow sense that we often think of is not really what's going on. Meditation is the meditation of life, you know. It's the craft of life. Craft in the sense of working with matter and spirit together. Mm-hmm. You know through your body, not just through your head. And I'm sorry, I'm carrying on here, but in some ways this has all come to the fore.
it's a great insight, so please continue.
Well, this is very close to me right now because I told you I have this group of students, and we have a team of professors. An architect, myself, a religion professor, and we have another man whose claim to fame, he doesn't have a PhD, but he's a world-famous craftsman. He's a woodworker. He's a carpenter. And my God, what these students are learning, I mean, I would like to believe, yeah, we read books and we talk about Taoism and all that kind of stuff, and they may learn a few things along the way. But how are they really learning? They're learning from this man, and they're learning in terms of what he teaches them. And he uses words, but of course he uses words to have them learn how to use a chisel, you know, and how to saw wood. And the beauty of that, Taoistically, is that, you know, in that other great text, which I referred to in passing, you know, the Tao Te Ching being the one everyone knows, the second great early text, and I would recommend to your readers that they should immediately run out and get a copy of the Zhuangzi, which is this other early text, which, unlike the Tao Te Ching, which is a kind of series of somewhat enigmatic poetic verses, the Zhuangzi is indeed, like the Gospels, it's a collection of parables, stories.
Oh, yes.
And it is instantly appealing, and Zhuangzi actually is my hero in all sorts of ways. He's the one that really has this wonderful, acerbic, humorous, at times even a scatological humor about the nature of things. And as you know, or you may not know, but it's true, that when people talk about Buddhism, and especially Americans, thinking, oh, the highest form of Buddhism, the essence of Buddhist tradition is Zen tradition. What is Zen? Zen is Taoist Buddhism. Mm. Zen is that form of Buddhism, when it gets to China, that is transformed by the spirit of Taoism. and it's the spirit of Zhuangzi that is there. And anyway, that's a long professorial digression to say that in the Zhuangzi, we have these wonderful passages about what it means to be a Taoist. And what he basically says is that, like a woodworker, there's a famous parable of Butcher Ding, you've got to get the knack of being yourself again. And the only way you can get the knack is, in a sense, to learn to be, let your body be free again, to learn the lessons of spontaneity in relation to the things of the world. So Butcher Ding, the way he becomes a Taoist is to learn how to use a meat cleaver, you know.
Yeah.
There's another story about a woodworker who, again, learns what the Tao is in terms of getting the knack working with wood, how you go with the grain of things. And that brings up another point, which I have to get in here, Carol, and I apologize, okay?
Go ahead, get it. This is such a rich conversation. I'm having so many other thoughts as you're speaking and making so many connections. But go ahead. I want to hear what's on your mind.
There's one thing I have to get in any discussion of Taoism, because every time I teach Taoism, and I think I'm having some success in terms of students appreciating this fascinating tradition. And often, by the way, when I teach Taoism, I have them read Tao Te Ching, Zhuangzi, of course, but I also have them read the person I consider maybe the most interesting American Taoist, who is the American author and science fiction writer Ursula Le Guin, who is, if you've read some of her novels, The Left Hand of Darkness and The Dispossessed, these are beautiful evocations of the Taoist spirit. You know, she's got her own version of the Tao Te Ching. Anyway, my point is, what drives me absolutely batty is when, after we've done this work, and I say, okay, now, dear student, what do you think Taoism is? And the first thing they'll say is, oh, yes, I've learned now that Taoism is going with the flow. And at that point, I go completely berserk. Because, yes, in a way, that's true. The problem is the world we live in, we are caught up in a whole series of completely dysfunctional flows. You've got to find your real flow, you know, before you can go with it. You know, the flows that have been handed to us in this world are the worst possible flows, you know. And so it's not just going with any old flow out there, you know. You have to find yourself to know what your own internal rhythm or your own flow is. And so doing, then, yes, you can engage in the world and dance with the Tao. You know, that's what Tai Chi is all about, learning to dance again with the Tao. And, yes, at that point, you are going with the grain of things. But just to say, oh, go with the flow, that doesn't mean a damn thing, you know.
Right, right. There's a whole lot of flows out there today.
Exactly.
I got to be careful of a bunch of
them. Pretty lousy flows.
Yes, I know. And, you know, what you shared before when you mentioned the stories that are like parables.
Mm-hmm.
In the Tao texts, as well as, you know, I'm understanding now why there's growth in some Christianity over there right now, because there is a lot of common ground in what I'm hearing. And what are parables? Parables are stories that tell you essentially how to garden, how to make bread, you know, how to work together in a vineyard, how to, you know, prune.
Yes.
Trees and all spiritually based, and what you say before about, you know, matter and spirit. You know, Norman, I think the entire universe is a natural combination of spirit and matter, and I think that's where our scientists are heading when they talk about things like dark matter and dark energy.
Absolutely.
That it's out there in the very fabric.
Quantum mechanics is suggesting to us that, again, the Taoists were always right. You know, there is that famous book, The Tao of Physics, written, God, 30, 40 years ago. And in some ways, it had more to do with Hindu ideas than it did Taoist ideas. But I think what you just said is very much the case, that, you know, when you get deeply into theoretical physics, it's no longer just a science. It is a form of mysticism, you know. And, all of these things are trying to tell us something about the real mystery of it all.
Well, in the few minutes that we have here towards the end of the program, this has been such a rich conversation. I think we could probably have another one. But in this chaos today that we're in with, you know, the economy, with the environment, with Occupy, with war, people burning holy books and such, how can a Taoist, you know, focus or awareness or practice help us in our life and in relating to others?
Well, I think, you know, in terms of everything we've been talking about, care, obviously, in many ways, but, you know, there are some things I would say. I mean, one is, as we've seen now over and over again, and I think often in the worst possible way, and I'm now alluding to the American political situation, the whole idea of American exceptionalism, which leads, I think, to sort of very scary conclusions. We need to get over that. You know, one of the lessons of Taoism is to be less aggressive, to be less assured of what we think is the right way. We need to learn to be more humble about our role in the world and our relationship with others if we're going to get along cooperatively, especially in the world today. You know, this is supposed to be a global world. We're supposed to be interconnected with everyone else. But when we have politicians who are invoking notions that somehow we as Americans have been given some kind of divine right to tell the rest of the world how to behave and what to do, and oh, by the way, if you don't do that, we're going to bomb you, that's scary, and that's not particularly Taoist, is it? Mm-hmm. And that, of course, relates to what we referred to, and we didn't really get a chance to get into, the whole relation between Taoism and ecology. And, you know, Taoist tradition is a tradition that, in the most profound way, is concerned about the interconnectedness of things, and really brings us back to another point you just made. You know, in some ways, what got me into all of this was when I was coming up as a young college boy, actually as a young Roman Catholic college boy going to a Jesuit school.
Oh, now it comes out.
But Ricky, the time when I was in school and started in 61, that's when Vatican II happened, and that, you know, everything changed at that point for the young Catholic boy. Suddenly we could look at all of this other amazing stuff, and that's how I ended up doing what I'm doing. But what I was actually leading up to, the other thing that was very influential on me and relates to this issue of Taoist tradition having a connection with the most advanced people thinking about the nature of the physical universe in terms of theoretical physics, quantum physics, etc., or the anticipation of evolutionary theory by Zhuangzi, is, of course, the great Jesuit paleontologist and, some would say, mystic Teilhard de Chardin.
Right.
And he was a very important figure for me when I was trying to find out who I was back in college and what I was going to do. I was actually in medical school for all the wrong reasons, because my parents, you know, decided I needed to carry on the family tradition. But who was I, and what was my path? What was my way? What was my Tao? And that's tough. You know, most of us in our lives, you know, we think we're making decisions all the time, but we're lucky if we make one real decision, you know, in our entire existence.
Yeah.
And at least for me, that was my first real decision to leave medical school and go off to study strange religions. My father never forgave me. But.
Oh, goodness. Well, but look at all the wonderful work you're doing now. And Norman, as we come to the end of the program, because I don't want you to get cut off, but I do want to let listeners know that your website and contact information will be posted on our homepage shortly at GodspeedInstitute.com. And I wanted to thank you so much for being on the program today. As I said, I think we could probably have another conversation and continue this at some point, if you would like to.
Well, sure, of course.
Sure. Okay.
If it's part of our path, Care, to do so, of course.
Yes. definitely. And before we close today, I wanted to share with you from someone else's path,
mm-hmm.
Martin Luther, actually. Mm-hmm. Perhaps listeners don't realize that the unintentional founder of the Reformation may have been a process psychologist. I didn't realize that either till I came across this remarkable text of his, which I'd like to share with you now.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote, "This life, therefore, is not godliness, but the process of becoming godly. Not health, but getting well. Not being, but becoming. Not rest, but exercise. We are not now what we shall be, but we are on the way. The process is not yet finished, but is actively going on. This is not the goal, but it is the right road. At present, everything does not gleam and sparkle, but everything is being cleansed."
Wow.
This 16th century reflection resonates so strongly over time. I wanted to share it with you. It has accompanied me over the years as an idea, a prayer, and a reminder. We are just fine in our imperfections. All is well. We are on the way and moving forward. That's our tip for our spiritual tool belt today that we wrap around ourselves. Norman, I wanted to thank you so much for being on the show today. It's been a total pleasure speaking with you.
And as they used to say in Star Wars, may the Tao be with you.
And also with you. And thank you, listeners, for joining us for the Godspeed Institute today. This program was recorded live on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City and produced by Michael Hallenbeck. If you'd like to hear this or any of our previous programs again or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. Please send your comments to office@GodspeedInstitute.com. We always enjoy hearing from you. The Godspeed Institute is an independent educational organization dedicated to promoting religious tolerance and celebrating the value of spiritually based living. Join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Until then, we wish you Godspeed on your journey.